Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Hospice New Zealand Genesis Oncology Trust Lecture Number 2. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. This morning, there will be a presentation followed by a question and answer session, and I must advise you that this conference is being recorded, and at this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Our speaker today is Diana Hart. Diana is a respiratory nurse practitioner. She works with complex respiratory patients in the community and at Middlemore Hospital in Auckland. We are delighted she joins us today to share her expertise around COPD. Welcome, Diana. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much for all making this early lecture. The reason I chose chronic obstructive pulmonary disease as my topic is because it has gained interest as a major public health concern, and it is currently the focus of intense research because of its persistently increasing prevalence, mortality, and disease burden. Next. What is COPD? Well, COPD is a chronic condition presenting as a slowly progressive breathlessness problem, often associated with cough and sputum production. And for many patients, they have been in denial of seeing any health professional with regard to these signs and symptoms for many years. It includes both chronic bronchitis and emphysema in variable proportions in any one patient, and it can be incredibly distressing to get the diagnosis. Next. The burden in COPD is estimated to affect 15% of all New Zealanders over the age of 45 years of age. It is the fourth leading cause of death in New Zealand behind cancer, heart disease and stroke, and it is permanent, disabling and frequently progressive, as I said earlier. Over 85% of cases of COPD are caused by inhalation of tobacco smoke. And this is quite often one of the reasons why many people don't seek to have any health professional input, because they feel that it is self-inflicted and they may get information that they don't really want to hear. It is actually estimated that there are 52 million sufferers worldwide, so it is a major concern. Next. The management of chronic disease is arguably the most significant challenge for healthcare systems, and the financial and social burden from chronic disease has been well documented, discussed, and debated for many years, but it is becoming an increasing problem. The potential for primary care to achieve reductions in avoidable mortality, avoidable hospital admissions, and to reduce health inequalities has become the basis for current government policy, and a great deal of financial input is being put into these policies. Next. This diagram is just one that I got out of a nursing journal depicting a severe COPD patient that we may all be familiar with, on oxygen, severely dyspneic, pursed-lip breathing, barrel chest, easily fatigued, very often complaining of frequent respiratory infections, use of all accessory muscles to breathe, very often has corpulmonale and late disease, and very often thin. Now, when I was first a respiratory nurse, asthma was often included in COPD diagnosis, and this doesn't really happen nowadays. We tend to stick to chronic bronchitis and emphysema. The reason for the link with asthma was because all the conditions have in common a wheeze, but nowadays we do tend to have asthma out on its own. Next. The economic burden. The main costs to the health system in New Zealand that are attributable to COPD include medications, hospital care, and of course primary care visits. As unlike in the UK, primary care is not fully funded. Additional costs accrue from laboratory services, emergency department visits, smoking cessation programs, other laboratory tests that are deemed necessary, and the provision of rehabilitation services, all of which are incredibly important but do cost money. Next. The morbidity. COPD results in a major deterioration in quality of life, particularly as the disease progresses to the severe stage. But even those patients who have mild to moderate condition do actually end up by being quite down sometimes, about the deterioration in their quality of life. The most significant symptom is progressive shortness of breath, which limits exercise capacity and coping with ordinary ADLs. Quality of life is also affected by poor mobility and social isolation. Next. Mortality. In 1999, COPD accounted for 5.1% of all deaths in New Zealand. The published mortality in New Zealand, however, is likely to understate the true health burden of COPD as the cause of death in patients, particularly those with severe COPD, as very often it is reported as other conditions. For example, COPD and left ventricular failure can get confused, and in hospital a patient may die of a myocardial infarction, but in actual fact they had COPD as a major underlying problem. As a consequence, the true mortality may be up to 2.5 times the published rate. Next. The prevalence. Although the prevalence of asthma is quite well understood in New Zealand, there are no reliable data for COPD from population surveys, and I'm hoping that after the next census we will be able to certainly look at this. The World Health Organization's global estimates from our region suggest that around 15% of adults over the age of 45 suffer from COPD. So this means that there are likely to be at least 200,000 cases of COPD amongst adults in New Zealand, of whom only 1 in 4 to 5 have had the diagnosis confirmed by a doctor. Next. Throughout Western countries, COPD is becoming increasingly prevalent, as the impact of higher levels of tobacco smoking since the 1930s have resulted in increasing numbers of cases of COPD. And as more of the baby boomers come through now being diagnosed, we will see the numbers increasing tremendously. In 1990, World Health Organization ranked COPD as number 12 in the list of diseases impacting on health worldwide, and it has predicted that COPD will rank 5 by 2020. But in New Zealand, it is already in the top 5. Next. Tobacco smoking, of course, is the main cause, but in addition, the prevalence of COPD is affected by cannabis smoking and certain occupations, including bakers, food processors, spray painters, chemical processors, agricultural workers, and jobs that expose people to dust and chemicals. The latter ones, though, only account for a small percentage of all cases. The majority of cases are the result of tobacco. Next. The prevalence of any one population is related to the prevalence of smoking and the age of the population. And based on hospital admission data, the prevalence for Māori is more than twice for non-Māori. Next. COPD is often associated with other conditions, comorbidities such as heart disease, and it is associated with an increased risk of myocardial infarction, stroke, lung cancer, and pneumonia. We've all heard of smoking causing lung cancer, but until comparatively recently, COPD wasn't actually well known. You could talk to people about COPD and they looked at you completely blank. They weren't sure what on earth was happening, what's happening to them. In many cases, there is a significant additional impact of anxiety or depression, and that's quite understandable being given the diagnosis of COPD nowadays. One knows it's a condition we cannot cure. Next. The diagnosis is confirmed by spirometry, demonstrating airflow obstruction. In spirometry, it is the FEV1 that is decreased and the FEV1/FVC that is reduced below 70 to 80% predicted. There is some reversibility in about two-thirds of the patients, and the FEV1 may increase by 12% or 200 mL post-bronchodilator. This doesn't necessarily mean the patients have not got COPD just because you have reversibility. And for those of you who are not familiar, FEV1, forced expiratory volume in first second. As the disease progresses, symptoms become more prominent. Lifestyle and quality of life are affected very adversely in many cases, and ultimately, patients become short of oxygen, leading to significant heart problems. When COPD is complicated by hypoxia, intimal and vascular smooth muscle thickening can cause pulmonary hypertension, which is a late and poor prognostic development. In severe cases of COPD, oxygen therapy may be provided as part of the management. Next. COPD deaths occur largely in older people, and rates for men have been around twice that of women. The difference between sexes, though, however, is closing and reflects the proportion of men and women who are currently smoking. Next. This diagram shows you the COPD mortality rates averaged over 3 years in New Zealand by sex, age and group and ethnicity per 100,000. As you can see, this number is still greater for men, particularly for Māori men, but women are creeping up. Next. Depending on the number of prevalent cases, the direct costs have been estimated at between 102 million to 192 million per annum. And hospital costs are estimated to cost 80 million per annum. The average cost per patient per year is estimated to be 2,566 without considering loss of income, costs to family, or loss of quality of life. Next. Now, chronic bronchitis is defined as hypersecretion of mucus and chronic productive cough that lasts for at least 3 months of the year for two consecutive years, and that has been a standard definition for many years. The incidence is increased in smokers and also in those workers exposed to air pollution. Next. The inspired irritants increase mucus production and also increase the size and number of mucus glands and goblet cells. The mucus becomes thicker and more tenacious than normal, which makes it much more likely that bacteria such as Haemophilus influenzae and Streptococcus pneumoniae will become embedded. And very often these two bugs are there permanently and patients become colonized. Very often the treatment is just for dampening these down. Next, the best treatment is prevention, stopping smoking. Now this can be incredibly difficult for many patients. Nicotine replacement therapy, Zyban, Champix, amitriptyline, the Quitline can all help. In fact, for many of my patients, I have the Quitline on their speed dial because certainly the first 4 minutes when they want to light up can be really vital, and I found the Quitline very helpful in managing to talk them through this next 4 minutes. And the Quitline is available anywhere from New Zealand, 0800 773 773. And a lot of my patients take advantage of it at any hour of the day. Nicotine replacement therapy is now offered as soon as patients enter hospital because we regard that as being very important to try and convince patients that stopping smoking is important. Many patients have found Champix helpful and Zyban, and the literature states now that Zyban in conjunction with nicotine replacement therapy can have greater success. Bronchodilators and expectorants increase airway caliber. They improve secretion clearance and maximize gas exchange. And I'll talk a little bit more in detail about them later. Physiotherapists can have a big role to play in regards to chest clearance techniques, and I use them a lot. Recognition of early signs of infection. And this is where the self-management plan comes into play. Patients can, given the right time and given the right education, can be taught to recognize early signs of infection. Even patients with poor health literacy, it can be worthwhile taking the time to explain early signs of infection and getting them to understand a not complicated, simple self-management plan. Some patients benefit from pictures, some patients benefit from actually talking to you, some patients benefit from actually doing it. So perhaps if you haven't got time yourself, perhaps another health professional in your team could be enlightening them on early signs of infection. But early recognition and treatment can be very important. We tend to only recommend steroids for severe exacerbations because there are many consequences of giving patients steroids inappropriately. Next. This is just a diagram I found in one of the journals, and I thought it was appropriate just to put it in there. The main help that patients can get is with smoking cessation. And I can't emphasize that enough. Nowadays in New Zealand, we need many aspects of this in regards to people can't smoke in many places. Unfortunately, there are still patients who still smoke outside the hospital I work, which doesn't create a very good impression. But all health professionals should take the first every opportunity to speak to people about smoking cessation. And I am, must admit, I am probably a bit of a dragon in doing that as well. Next, emphysema. Emphysema is abnormal permanent enlargement of the acini with accompanying destruction of alveolar walls, but without obvious fibrosis. Septal destruction eliminates portions of the pulmonary capillary bed and increases air in the acinus. Hyperinflation of the alveoli causes large air spaces to develop, and we call these bulli. Next. The main mechanism of airflow limitation is loss of elastic recoil. Expiration becomes difficult due to loss of elastic recoil, which reduces the volume of air expired passively. And in fact, patients usually complain to you that they literally run out of air. And this is what happens, is they blow up like a balloon, and unless they get some air out, they can't get any more air in. And that can be incredibly debilitating and stops people from going out. In early life, emphysema may be a result of the alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. And this usually occurs, gets recognized in the fourth or fifth decade. And so a blood test to determine whether this is a factor should be done if COPD is diagnosed under the age of 50. Of course, if there is an alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, there are all sorts of problems with genetic counseling that may be required, and certainly to encourage the rest of the family to stop smoking, or if they have not smoked, not even take it up. Next. Septal destruction also affects airway caliber. An additional airway narrowing can also result from the inflammatory hyperreactivity of the bronchi with bronchoconstriction. And next, the next slide sums it up really. The pathogenesis, exposure to these irritants or noxious particles, results in lung inflammation. Then you have parenchymal destruction, loss of alveolar attachment, decrease of elastic recoil causing airflow limitation. And on the airway side, you have small airway disease from airway inflammation, airway remodeling, again resulting in airflow limitation. Next. And here's a chest x-ray of the very hyperinflated lungs. This patient has got severe disease, and you can see the flattened diaphragms on both the lateral and on the AP view. Now, this is a case study of a typical patient that I often see in clinic. A gentleman, 67 years, married, retired police detective, stressful occupation, weight 64 kgs. Now, this should be alerting people a little bit because his height is 80 centimeters. So he's quite tall, but he's obviously very thin. He has a smoking pack history of 45 pack years. And for those of you who aren't quite sure what pack years means, a pack year is defined as 20 cigarettes smoked every day for 1 year. So if a patient smoked one packet a day for 20 years, he would have a 20-pack year history. If he smoked 40 cigarettes a day for 20 years, he had a 40-pack year history. So this will give you some idea of how long this gentleman has been smoking. Now, he told me he could walk 4 to 5 kilometers, but now was only down to about 0.5 kilometers. And even watching him walk into clinic, that was probably a stretch. And he starts to become short of breath. He cannot attempt hills now. This was becoming a major issue, particularly with regards to his occupation. His past medical history, hypertension, and he was on appropriate medications for that, Acupil 5 milligrams daily, Lipex 20 milligrams Noctay. Next, treatment. His main emphasis for treatment was to encourage him to stop smoking. This took many attempts. We had him on NRT patches, even double NRT patches, for about 3 to 4 weeks. Of course, patches have to be rotated. It's very important not to put them all on the same side. He did end up by having a combination of Zyban and NRT to help, but it took many months and many attempts and many phone calls to quit Lyme. In fact, his wife became desperate that he would never eventually stop smoking, but finally he did. We then used bronchodilators. The gold standard are anticholinergic agents, ipratropium bromide is the main therapy. Nowadays, ipratropium bromide is available in the longer-acting version, Spiriva, but the patient has to have spirometry done to check whether he actually qualifies for it under PharmAct rules, FEV1 less than 60% predicted, so spirometry has to be done. It's also very important to check the metered-dose inhaler techniques when patients are on metered-dose inhalers, as they develop many strange occurrences and strange attitudes to using metered-dose inhalers, and also a spacer may be very beneficial. Some people still think spacers are only for children, but they're not. Anybody who has a metered-dose inhaler should be offered one and shown how to use it, and their technique rechecked virtually every time they attend a health professional. It surprises me how many people go into the internet and see other different ways of doing things and try and show me how they should be doing it, how I should be teaching people how to do it. And 99% of the time, I usually have an answer as to why we don't teach them that way. If a patient can have Spiriva, it means they only have to have the anticholinergic medication once a day. The biggest problem to Spiriva is it can make the patient's mouth quite dry, and it can have consequences for patients who have glaucoma or have problems with constipation, so that should be monitored. We also use short-acting beta agonists, salbutamol, but again, cautiously, particularly for patients who have cardiac conditions. But to have a patient who has severe disease, say they take the salbutamol inhaler 6-7 times a day is not unusual. Glucocorticosteroids. In a small percentage, these may be helpful. We tend to try to avoid using them if at all possible, but some patients do actually find it helpful, and if, of course, they have an asthma component, then we do encourage them to use them. But again, if they have glucocorticosteroids inhaled particularly, they need to be encouraged to wash the mouth out, even after using a spacer, otherwise oral thrush can be a persistent problem and very difficult to get rid of. There is level A evidence that referral to pulmonary rehabilitation is very important. Now, any health professional can refer to the local pulmonary rehabilitation program, and throughout New Zealand, most of the big hospitals have pulmonary rehabilitation, and even the bigger hospitals are now having community outreach pulmonary rehabilitation. But patients do find this really very, very beneficial. It tends to be called the exercise program, which can put some people off to start off with, but it's exercise under controlled conditions with a personalized regime, and the interaction of other patients attending the pulmonary rehabilitation program can be very beneficial for patients to realize that they're not alone and isolated, and that other people around in the community do have this condition. Lung volume reduction. Well, in a few patients, this has proved very beneficial, but only a very few. And it's usually only those patients who have emphysema in the upper lobes. So first of all, a respiratory physician referral would be required, and then an HRCT of the chest, and then the discussion. Oxygen therapy. Now, a PaO2 of 7.3 kilopascals, or certainly with evidence of cor pulmonale 8, can be the only major criteria for obtaining fully funded oxygen therapy in New Zealand. Patients tend to equate breathlessness with needing oxygen, and that's one of the main faults that we have with the hospital, because as soon as patients enter hospital breathlessness, they get treated with oxygen therapy. And this gives patients the wrong perception that breathlessness must be treated with oxygen therapy. But there is evidence, and this has been obtained from two studies done admittedly several years ago in the UK, that oxygen therapy is beneficial if patients reach a certain stage, 7.8 kilopascals of mercury PaO2. There is at present a big study being done in the US to confirm that this is still applicable, but at the moment, publicly funded oxygen will only be given if patients fulfill the criteria. And this can sometimes be quite upsetting for patients because they get the perception that they should be having it, as they always had it in hospital. So if you're considering oxygen therapy and a referral to the oxygen service in your area, please make sure that the patient has sat for 15 to 20 minutes and then put the pulse oximeter on them and see what their oxygen saturations are. Of course, if they're anemic, it can be a bit deceptive, and a pulse oximeter, remember, is only one tool. So patients could be referred to oxygen clinic if they have those saturations of 90% or below, but please make sure the patients have been sitting quietly for at least 15 to 20 minutes and have not just arrived in your consulting room. The annual flu vaccine is really important, and more patients are now becoming aware that this is important, particularly after the last influenza epidemic in the Northern Hemisphere this last winter. We're hoping that even more patients will have the annual flu vaccine this year. And the five-yearly pneumonia vaccine, there is now evidence to say that that is very beneficial too. Next. Now, end-of-life issues. These have become increasingly a discussion point of view about severe COPD patients. They have a five-year mortality of about 50%. So end-of-life issues really do need to be discussed. Patients' families need to be told and asked what goals. I call them my patients' bucket lists. Patients are encouraged to involve all their family in these discussions because nursing a patient is not just nursing the one patient with severe disease, it's looking after the whole family. So I encourage patients to have a family meeting and discuss the end-of-life issues, particularly once they have reached a severe stage. For COPD patients who require mechanical ventilation, there is now evidence that there is a one-year mortality of over 60%. And advanced directives and end-of-life care can be an integral part of the comprehensive management of patients with COPD. I try to encourage it to start in primary care, be reinforced in secondary care, and then go back to primary care, but all health professionals involved in case management or any management of these patients, particularly once they reach a severe stage, should be encouraged to discuss end-of-life issues. I have had a few patients who've come into hospital had a disastrous time as far as they were concerned. They were put on ventilator machines in the ED department that they didn't want. They were resuscitated when they didn't want it. Get home afterwards and say, I never want to go through that again. But if we'd had end-of-life discussions earlier, that hopefully wouldn't have happened. So I'm making it a point of my practice now to make quite sure that these issues are addressed. And there are many more courses now to make people feel comfortable about going through this discussion. It can be very sensitive, and it's appropriate to choose the right time, not when patients have only got a 5 or 10 minute consultation. They will need to have time set aside for this to be done properly. Next. Now, managing breathlessness. Progressive breathlessness on exertion is a key feature of COPD. Everyday activities, such as washing and dressing, can cause debilitating and very disabling breathlessness. There is a score sheet called the Nottingham score, which I used in a study recently, that just discussed everyday things like doing household chores, managing to dress yourself, managing to shower yourself, managing to do your own cooking. That can be quite a useful tool just to go through the patients and see exactly what their score is. Very often their response to such experiences as doing housework means they avoid the activity. Some patients, for example, can no longer clean their shower, can no longer vacuum, can no longer make the bed. In fact, dressing themselves can take at least an hour in the morning, and very often they will walk around in their nightdress or pajamas until midday. This lack of exercise or any activity can cause downward deconditioning, spiraling whereby cardiovascular fitness decreases, skeletal muscle mass loss is lost, and patients become increasingly more breathless. Next. Nutrition. Normally, Normal, healthy eating advice should form part of a routine patient education in COPD. In severe disease, however, weight loss is extremely common. If you watch a patient who's breathing really hard in end-stage COPD, they're using a lot of energy. But the mechanisms behind weight loss are not completely understood, but they are likely to be a combination of systemic inflammation and a simple energy expenditure versus intake imbalance. So what we now find recommended, and these are from our dietitians at Middlemore Hospital, is they recommend 6 frequent small meals, and patients may need referring to dietitians for supplements such as Sustagen or Fortisip. There are not as many funded ones as there used to be, but it is important not to wait until the weight loss has become too crucial before the dietitian's input is sought. Severe nutrition deficiency is often associated with poor prognosis. Next. Now, exacerbations. These are extremely distressing, disruptive, and disabling, and their true effects can actually last for up to 4 months. I tell patients once they get an exacerbation, they're not going to be up and running again in about the next 2 to 3 weeks. It is going to take quite a time for convalescence. Frequent exacerbations increase disease progression and can lead to significant loss of quality of life. So we need to discuss with patients how to avoid these exacerbations, if at all possible, and how to manage them if they occur. As I stated earlier, self-management is becoming increasingly important. Literature recently in the New England Journal of Medicine talked about the use of macrolides for COPD. Now, macrolides have an immune-modifying activity in addition to their direct pathogenic targeting effects. The main problem, though, is their potential for resistance. In the New England Journal in 2011, Albert et al. Also discussed that there was a delay in time for exacerbation using azithromycin. But one of the big problems of using azithromycin is that it is a pro-arrhythmogenic, causing abnormal heart rhythms. But azithromycin used 3 times a week did not seem to have such a problem with this. Next. The psychological problems and social isolation associated with this condition are immense. Restlessness saps energy and confidence. It reduces independence and causes loss of role and self-esteem, and patients very often withdraw into themselves. So it is hardly surprising that depression is very common in severe COPD, but very often not recognized. All health professionals caring for COPD patients need to be alerted to the signs of depression. Now, I'm not advocating that we necessarily go in for more pills, and sometimes patients don't want more pills. Sometimes just being able to talk about their problems and having them recognized can be an important event and very helpful. I found a number of patients who I knew when they had early disease, as they gradually progressed, get to know me quite well, and I can recognize signs and symptoms of depression. And those of you who work in primary care will also be able to recognize these patients. So using pills is not necessarily going to be the main treatment. Sometimes I do the health and anxiety and depression score to see if these patients have actually got depression. But even then, that cannot always pick these patients up. Some of them I refer to clinical psychologists. But a major depressive episode should definitely be treated, and it may help the patient to come to terms more with this condition. Social isolation. A lot of these patients, particularly once they start on home oxygen, are not allowed to drive anymore, or certainly feel that driving would be very unsafe, and this is probably the major case. Occasionally I have a patient who has to drive, particularly if they live in a very isolated area, but I stress that they only drive very locally, and I may well ask the oxygen service to give them an oxygen cylinder in their car, well strapped in so that it doesn't act like a missile, to enable them to get out more. But of course, once they arrive at their destination, they have to cope with the breathlessness. A few of my patients have qualified for portable oxygen, but only very few. Portable oxygen, in order to get it, patients have to jump through many hoops, and it is not very often funded, certainly from the DHB I work at. If the patient is younger and more likely to be able to do fulfill a job, they may qualify more for portable oxygen, but it is not very common. Usually they're only given a concentrator, and that is not portable. That is very definitely in the house and only a 50-foot tubing given. So social isolation is a major issue. I have one or two patients who've managed to get mobility scooters through the Lotteries Commission, and a few patients who've managed to fund their own mobility scooters. And I see them occasionally going down the road with their oxygen bottle attached to the back. But this is not the norm. Very often I go around and see patients who haven't seen anybody for days, apart from the Meals on Wheels person who's delivered their food. So social isolation is a major issue. Next. Family and relationship problems. Long-term illness places considerable strains on families and partners. This is where respite care can be very beneficial. Many patients don't realize that there are facilities whereby they can spend up to 28 to 30 days a year to give their families and partners and caregivers some respite from looking after them. Looking after a patient who has late end-stage COPD 24 hours a day can be very draining. And carers can often suffer from anxiety and depression themselves as a result from this. Many of them have to give up work. And this can cause an additional domestic burden as they shoulder added problems. And this can produce feelings of resentment on their part and guilt on the part of the patient, causing the person now to be only looking after them and perhaps not able to go to work. COPD affects, on the whole, older people. And a patient's main caregiver may also be elderly and ill, and this can place an additional burden. So referral to the needs assessment team at the local hospital can be really important to make quite sure that respite care is available. Many patients do not wish to go into private hospital. And nowadays, we are recognizing that as health professionals, that this is probably going to be a major issue for a lot of us to convince patients that the private hospital is an option, but also to actually make quite sure that as many options are available for looking after people at home. Because COPD is progressive, long-term, and eventually is regarded as a terminal illness. Next. So in summary, the main aims of treatment should be to enable patients not simply to live with COPD, but to have a life with it. I have many patients who 5 or 10 years ago were told they had only a few months to live, but are still managing to battle on in the community and managing to live at home. We do have a few hospital admissions, but not for very long, and they get back home again, and along with their primary care team, we manage those patients, and that's where the patients want to live. They want to have their life. I look after some elderly people, particularly people who live remotely, and they want to pass away on their farm, for example. They do not wish to end their lives in some private hospital institution. And part of my role is ensuring that this can happen as far safely as possible in conjunction with the primary care team. In fact, sometimes in remote areas, I'm sometimes regarded by the primary care team as their eyes and ears for some of these patients. And with appropriate treatment and support, it is possible to put quality back into their remaining years. Some patients like to know how long they're going to have left, and that can be very difficult. It's not like it used to be in the old days, where we used to say once a patient went on home oxygen, we said they possibly only had about 12 months. Nowadays, patients can be on home oxygen and still be with us quite a few years later. So we have to plan for this, and the health system has to acknowledge that this has to be planned for. And we have to make quite sure that families understand that this is a long-term condition that will possibly result in quite a lengthy deterioration and eventually death, but death may not occur in the immediate future. Of course, sometimes it does. Other comorbidities may intervene. I had a patient the other day who's had COPD diagnosed in severe stage for the last 8 years, but unfortunately had a myocardial infarction, which caused him to pass away very suddenly. His family were very unhappy, of course, but in the end they did admit that he'd had a reasonable quality of life with input from a vast number of health professionals. Thank you very much for listening.